A few weeks ago, Hans and I, he's our producer. A few weeks ago, Hans and I invited some people to the Fitzgerald Theater in downtown St. Paul, Minnesota for a live show of Terrible Thanks for Asking. It was so much fun to get to stand in front of so many people who have made this show possible, who have made it possible for Hans and I to do this for officially a year. Go us. So you're going to hear some of the tape from that night. Not all of it. We did present a TTFA story live, and that's a story you'll actually hear next week. It was a two-hour show, and we've heard the numbers don't lie. People don't want to listen to a two-hour podcast, which I find bonkers. I want to listen to like a 100-hour podcast. I want my life to be a podcast that never ends. It was not your typical Terrible Thanks for Asking show. We had some friends there with us that you will meet, the comedian Alyssa Lamparis, our incredible theme songwriter Joffrey Wilson, and Dessa, who a lot of you already know Dessa, but if you don't, she is a singer, a rapper, FYI, in the notes that we wrote rapper with a W, as if she is best known for her gift-giving capabilities, which I'm sure are above par, but she's the like music kind of rapper. She's been on the Hamilton mixtape. She's been profiled in Forbes. She is the president of Minneapolis's Doomtree Records. So if you are in Minneapolis, St. Paul, chances are you know who Dessa is, but we got listeners everywhere. And plus, I just wanted to be polite. I wanted to be a good host. So I started out our show just taking the temperature of the room, just asking. Has anyone here, show of hands, heard of Dessa? So me neither, but we decided to take a chance on an unknown gal and see what she could do. I am not exaggerating when I say that Dessa is an Amazon goddess from another planet, and every single person I've ever met who knows who Dessa is like, yes, I would amputate my own leg to like be around her in any capacity. And so I was pretty shocked to hear that all of those heartbroken rap songs she sings are like autobiographical. I was like, what? No. That does not make sense to me. She's here tonight to talk to us about all of those love songs and where they came from. So here's Dessa.
My name is Dessa. As Nora kindly said, I am a rapper and a singer based here in the Twin Cities. I am also a member of the Doomtree Collective. I am also the one who writes really sad love songs. So even at like a really grimy, loud, noisy rap show where there's a lot of sweating, there's a lot of whiskey, there's a lot of like unintentional body checks and a lot of totally intentional body checking, I perform torch songs. And if that's a term with which you're not familiar, a torch song is a tune that's usually sung from a woman's perspective who is in like a desperate, pathetic, completely non-viable love. And when I sent my last record to my mom, she wrote me back an email and she said she thought the harmonies were really pretty and I was a good writer. I was like, you have to say that you're my mom. But she asked, like, why is it always so sad? And she accused me of writing music to bleed out to. Which was arresting because who are you hanging out with, Mom? And I've made light of it, to be totally frank and public for a very long time, of this like unending angst. And people on Twitter sometimes write things like, hey, release new music or a book, I need help with my breakup. And other people on Twitter have posted like in a loving and supportive way that they hope that I'm dumped soon so that I will release new music. But what I haven't mentioned publicly as much is that the past 10 years of 12 years of sad songs have mostly been written about the same dude. And what has been a minor boom for the career of an indie musician has not been a boon for her personal life. And I had been not only devastated, but like really embarrassed about why I couldn't get over what everybody else seems to be able to get over. And I loved this dude so much that it felt like crazy making and compulsive, and I wasn't proud of the thoughts that I was having. I was considering making compromises that were so significant that they didn't feel like compromise. They felt like absolute concession. You know, like, could I be with this dude if he decided that he was polyamorous and gonna sleep with other people, even if I didn't have an interest in it? And would I be willing to have a life with less happiness in it if it was a life I got to spend with him? And I wasn't sure how to reconcile any of that with feminism. Like, what kind of woman would consider making that concession for a man? So I was particularly excited when I saw a TED Talk. It was by a woman named Dr. Helen Fisher. She's an anthropologist. She studies human intimacy, and she does a lot of research on the brain. And in watching her discussion, I learned that she had spent a good chunk of her time trying to find the particular location in the human brain in which romantic love resides. And even that objective was surprising to me. It hadn't occurred to me that there would be a distinct location for romantic love. But according to some of her findings, as I started scrolling through the published scientific literature, not only was there a specific locus, but the romantic love would light up with activity in different regions of your brain, even than the love you felt for a sibling, or for a daughter, or for a friend. And so I thought, if I could find the love in my brain, maybe I could make it stop. So, I sent a tweet. Anybody got access to an fMRI lab, like at midnight or something? I'll trade for backstage passes and whiskey. And it worked. I met Dr. Cheryl Ullman. She works at the University of Minnesota in the Center for Magnetic Resonance Research. I explained to her what I was trying to do. She took me on. We started delving into the math, the science, the protocol that Dr. Helen Fisher had used. She got me set up with a pair of forest green scrubs, told me to take off all of my jewelry and to make sure not to wear panties that had any silver threads, because those would heat up in the machine. And we started imaging my brain in love. So, for those of you who haven't been in an fMRI machine before, essentially it's a big tubular magnet into which the human body is advanced. And this magnet is monitoring a particular kind of iron in your blood, deoxygenated hemoglobin. So what it's doing is figuring out which parts of your brain are most active during any given task by tracking which parts of your brain are making the biggest metabolic demand. So for example, if I tap my right finger, every time I do that, there's a particular region kind of on the top of my head on the left side that will light up because it's the part of my brain that's responsible for my middle right finger. So I went into the machine, and I looked at two kinds of images. One set of pictures was of my ex-boyfriend. The other set of images was of a dude who looked a little bit like my ex-boyfriend, who I happened to find physically attractive, who I actually knew a little bit and liked well enough, but with whom I was not in love. So he was the control. My ex-boyfriend, of course, was the experimental stimulus. And in between those images, I would be asked to count back while I'm lying in this fMRI machine by sevens from a very large four-digit number. That was essentially simply to etch-a-sketch my brain in the same way that you might smell coffee between perfume samples to make sure we had a clean data set of my actual responses cortically to both of these dudes. And when we were done, we could see exactly which parts of my brain were active during each phase of the experiment, the count back, the control images, and the experimental images. And we could subtract the activity that my brain demonstrated while looking at the control image from the activity that it demonstrated while I looked at my ex-boyfriend. So essentially, your brain is active all the time doing a bunch of stuff, right? While I was looking at both sets of images, for example, part of my brain was busy just breathing. Part of my brain was also busy doing facial recognition chores. But in this way, we were able to try to isolate the love alone in the same way that if I stepped on a bathroom scale naked and then I stepped on it again when I was fully dressed, the difference between those two numbers would be the weight of my clothing, right? And what we found was activations in exactly the regions that Dr. Helen Fisher's study would have anticipated. There's a dot called the ventral tegmental area that lit up. There's the anterior cingulate. And there's also sort of an ugly, ungainly set of ram's horns right in the middle of your head. That was called the caudate. And predictably and significantly, it lit up only when I looked at images of my ex-boyfriend. So I was able to leave our work together with like a printout of my brain in love. And I imagined it in my head like a taproot. And now all I had to do was pull it out. So, I decided to try a technique called neural feedback. This is a treatment that's sometimes used experimentally on veterans with PTSD, on kids with autism, or on people who have epilepsy. And I found a technician named Penny Jean Grace Fire who was willing to work with me. I told her what I was trying to do. She took me on. She affixed 22 electrodes to my scalp. Those electrodes were sensitive enough to detect my brain waves through my skull and skin. And we did 2 or 3 sessions a day. And this is how it worked. As soon as I was hooked up, I could see my raw brainwave data. But then, even more importantly, I could see how the activity in my brain compared with healthy levels of activity in other 35-and-a-half-year-old female right-handed people. So I could see which parts of my brain were consistently hyperactive, which parts were underactive, and which parts were operating in kind of a Goldilocks region of healthy range. And we focused in on the part of my brain that we knew was going to be associated with emotional regulation. So I sat with 22 electrodes affixed to my head. And I watched as my brain spun at approximately the rate of a Euro machine. And you can hear there's like a chiming, a vibraphone chiming here. The software that Penny Jean Gracefire used is designed to only provide a feedback audio signal when my brain was operating within the desired thresholds. So I knew that when my brain turned green, that was the Goldilocks zone. When the bells went off, that was a good thing. It meant that my brain was operating in the desired healthy range. And that was it. I didn't have to, I wasn't like meditating. Like I didn't have to think about anything in particular. Penny Jean describes it as unconscious learning. And I admit, and she knew right away, that I'm something of a skeptic. I'm science-minded. I like this stuff. And I had never heard that term before. But I thought about the way that I learned to ride a bike. It wasn't in like a rational, conscious, willful manipulation of my balance muscles, right? They're doing stuff that I'm probably not fully aware of. And I also thought about Pavlov's dogs. It's not like each dog was asked to read a white paper on steak and bell, right? It was just in the fact that those stimuli were simultaneously presented consistently enough that there was an association made. So similarly here, with the lights that my brain generated on my dad's TV and with the sound that her software created, we were asking my brain to learn what the healthy ranges of activity were. Because essentially, as Penny Jean described, it's not like we're trying to lobotomize the love. It's not like we're trying to deaden any given region of my brain. It was instead like we were trying to train a muscle at the gym to be strong and flexible and resilient and to react appropriately to its environment. So when I'm in love, when I'm in a viable romantic relationship, that part of my brain should bloom in activity. But when I'm not in love, eventually it should chill the fuck out. When I was partway through the sessions, my dad asked how I was feeling. And I didn't really want to answer. Not because I didn't want to talk to my dad, but because I didn't want to call up the idea of my ex and see how I felt about it yet. I felt like that would be opening the oven before the souffle was done. I wanted to finish the sessions, then I wanted to go back to the University of Minnesota, get into the tube magnet, take another reading and see if my brain had changed. So I finished with Penny Jean, I got on a plane, I came back to Minneapolis. And effectively, my brain hadn't demonstrated the same kind of preference that it had. So now I ask myself, okay, do you feel different? And it wasn't that the love was gone. The love was, I could still find it, but I didn't feel crazy made, and I didn't feel so compulsive, and my heart wouldn't race and my neck wouldn't stiffen in the same way. It was like I had all the same feelings, the same inventory of a dozen feelings that you might have for a lover in your romantic past, right? Those include love, attraction, and jealousy, and bitterness, and tenderness. And it felt like after this experience, those feelings had just been resequenced so that the good stuff, the amity, the respect, the positive regard, those had floated to the top. And that might sound like a small thing, this resequencing of feelings, but essentially if I'm a dentist and I say, I am going to remove your wisdom teeth and I'm also going to anesthetize you, you really care what order I do those things in. Like the sequencing felt like absolutely everything. And I also felt not only better, but I felt philosophically privileged. I had held love in my hand because I asked the lab to print a 3D version on the 3D printer. And then with the help of a friend named Becky Hoffman, we decided to make an enormous version and cover it in little tiny disco pieces so that I could suspend it from the ceiling at my shows. And then I bronzed it and I'm wearing it on my neck. Love is not a perfect symmetrical construction paper pink Valentine's heart with a lace rim. Love is a hideous set of ram's horns buried in the middle of your head that goes off like a warehouse rave when that special someone walks by. And if he loves you back, then you fan the flames. And if he doesn't, you hire a team of neuroscientists to put them out.
So we have the greatest theme music, I believe, in the world, partially because, like, I have excellent taste, and partially because it was written and created by my friend Joffrey Wilson.
It's the life that you live. It's the tide rushing in. It's the standing alone. I'm a man on my own. It's the changing of locks, or the losing of causes. When I meant you no harm, when I sound the alarm, lying in the garden of DC, hanging on by the skin of my teeth. Did you drink lemonade from the fruit that we made? Did the taste in your mouth cause your pain turn you out? Did you move in the breeze? Did you get down on your knees? Or did you beg your lover, please? Baby, don't leave, don't leave. Lying in the garden of deceive, hanging on by the skin of my teeth, living with a rope wrapped round my neck. Waiting just to walk right off that ledge. Do the streets look the same? Do you eat the same places? And did you redecorate? Change the forks and the plates?
That's Joffrey Wilson. He wrote our theme music, and he is so talented. We're going to take a quick break here.
I just feel like we are surrounded in this world by bullshit.
So how can you know what's real and what's not? Science versus. That's how. We answer questions like, does anti-aging skincare actually work? And what is your true personality type? And to answer these questions, we don't use opinions. We dive into the scientific studies, talk to the experts, and put it in a podcast that I know you are gonna love. Listen to Science Versus on Spotify.
One of my favorite things about having the Terrible Club, which is our member group for our supporters, is that it just helps us get to know our listeners so much better, like actually meet them and get to know them. And it's so wonderful. We actually invited any Terrible Club members who had tickets to the show at the Fitzgerald to join us before the show. I got to meet so many people who I've gotten to know through a Facebook group and then meet them in real life. That means a lot to me. So if you are already one of our members, thank you so much. Truly, I cannot overstate it. If you are not a part of the club, doors always open, okay? We're always taking new members. You can donate at ttfa.org/donate. So we're back with Alyssa Lamparis, who is an esteemed member of the Dead Dad Club, which I also belong to. Anyone else? Anyone else out there got a dead dad? Yay! Yay for us. So Alyssa is also a comedian, which means that the natural coping mechanism after her dad died of brain cancer was to make a one-woman comedy show about it. It's called No Bad Days. Alyssa has also written and starred in so many viral videos for The Scene, which are all on Facebook, but she joined us on stage at the Fitzgerald to make us laugh about dead people.
My dad was diagnosed with terminal brain cancer in October of 2014, and then he passed away in October of 2015. And then this morning I went to a cafe and they didn't have almond milk. So it's like, pile it on. Oh my God. Oh my God. I had to drink it black. I had to drink my coffee black. We all have a cross to bear, okay? We're all fighting our own battles. Don't forget that. Don't forget that. Yeah. He died of glioblastoma, which some of you might know or at least anyone who's been within a million mile radius of me ever. Wow. I talk about it constantly. Oh, God, a telemarketer could call me and just be like, "Hi, I'd like to inform you that you're pre-approved for a credit card." And I'm like, wow, this is a crazy freaking coincidence. My dad died. Yep, he died, and I'd love to chat about it. What was that? Zero APR? Great. I'd love to pick your brain about grief. Yeah. Click. I'm the only person to, like, ever get hung up on by a telemarketer, you know? Like, they screen my calls. They're like, no, don't pick up. No, that's her. Yeah. I talk about it so much because it's just like, well, two reasons. One, I'm a very emotional person. You know, took me 4 years to get over my high school boyfriend. And he didn't even know we were dating. Okay. I'm like, oh my God, it's our song. He's like, get off my lawn. What's your name? I don't remember. I'm like, I got tattoos. I got matching tattoos. He's like, I have a restraining order. Okay. Great. But also my dad was just an awesome guy. He was so awesome. He was so youthful. He was like such a kid. He had so much energy and he like poured it into exercise big time. This man exercised every single day for 35 years. We were on a bus in Argentina. And it was a 24-hour bus, which is so long. And still, my dad was like, well, can't miss a day of running. So he got up, and just next to these Argentine people, he just started running. And he clocked what he thought was 3.1 miles in 34 minutes on a moving bus. Oh, God. Yeah, he really, I think he was a very anxious person, and he just kind of channeled that all into exercise, which I get because I'm a very anxious person, too. But I kind of take that, and I just kind of channel it into constantly thinking I'm pregnant. You know? I kind of just take all that energy, and I just shove it into just constant pregnancy tests. Yeah, I've taken Plan B more times than I've had sex, okay? I always think I'm pregnant, constantly. Even when I'm on my period, I'm like, I don't know. I mean, I hope. Okay, knock on wood, it's my period. Could be the baby with the bloody nose. Okay, all these GMOs, you don't know. You don't know. Grief is different for everyone. My mom is very much not like that. She really loves tangible signs. She clings to them, and that's great, but she kind of goes, like, too far. Like, she'll just be like, oh, my God, Mark, Alyssa, you got to come here. No, you got to see this. You're never going to believe it. Come here, get down. Okay, you see back there? You see that kind of pile of piss? You see that? Back behind the toilet? If you look close... there's a penny. And guess what? It's heads up. That's your father. I read it in a book. It's heads up. It's like, what? No. What? Like, she's like, oh, my God. Would you believe it? Alyssa, Mark, in the middle of New York City, a feather. Mom, do you mean the pack of dead pigeons? It's a sign. It's an angel. It's your father. That's how they come to us. I feel like I could be like, Mom, bad news. I have bed bugs. And she'd be like, that's your father killing you very close. Oh, my God. Oh, I'd kill for that sign. Oh, gosh. I feel like, you know, after a bad breakup, they're like, for a while, you just don't see anyone. You're just like slogging through. And then eventually you start like for the first time noticing people again. You're like, oh, he's kind of hot. I feel like I'm getting to that stage with dads. Not in like a sexual way. But I'll just be walking down the street and be like, ooh,
That's salt and pepper hair. I bet he knows how many dependents I need to put for my W-2.
Yeah.
Just like, ooh, I get a load of that dad bod. Oh, I bet he could build me some shelves. I see a pack of dads. I'm like, oh, damn, they could help me move. Oh, God. It's weird
having one parent. I feel like I'm walking around constantly with, like, an iPhone without a case on it, you know? Just like, I'm fine. But if this goes, I don't know what to do with myself. I like so protective of my mom. I'm like, mom, put a seatbelt on. She's like, we're watching a movie. It's a horror, you never know. Okay, guys, I'm Alyssa Lynn Paris. It's been so nice hanging with you guys. Thank you so much, bye.
Well, all my life I wondered about the measure of a man. He's a fool, does he know the life he's under? What he's holding in the palm of his hand. All of my life I waited for you to come. The devil keeps coming and a man can't always run. Your daddy played possum and your mama, she carries a gun. And I'm lost. I'm a wildfire burning. I'm a voice in the devil's chorus. I'm a dog, I'm a sleepy morning. I'm love and I'm coming without warning. Jesse was a keeper and your mama was asleep where she was. I caught him by the creek playing cowboys and Indians. I followed that river till the sun fell through the pine. And all my life I wondered about the measure of a man. He's a fool, does he know the life he's under? Well, he's holding in the palm of his hand. And I'm lost, I'm a wildfire burning. I'm a voice in the devil's chorus. I'm a dog, I'm a sleepy morning. I'm love and I'm coming without warning. I'm lost, I'm a wildfire burning. I'm a voice in the devil's chorus. I'm a dog, I'm a sleepy morning. I'm love and I'm coming without warning. I'm lost, I'm a wildfire burning. I'm a voice in the devil's chorus. I am a dog, I'm a sleepy morning. I'm love and I'm coming with without
That's Joffrey Wilson. His band with his beautiful wife Hannah is just Postbellum. It's one of my favorite songs.
Dessa.
Nora.
Like I was saying, is that disturbing to anyone else that Dessa would have a relationship issue? Or is it just me? I don't mean that to like make you feel bad. It's just that you are a true Amazon, and so I'm concerned about just, I mean, everything in the world seems off balance from what I just heard you present. Also,
it feels off balance.
Where was this scientist when I was in high school? Because I spent 10 years.
Did you 10, full 10, real life?
Oh, full 10. Oh. Nice, full 10. Rounded it out. To a decade. I was like, what if no one else loves me?
Right. Did he know that you were full tenning it or?
Oh yeah. We were together. Okay. Yeah. We were straight up together. And I was like, he might be here. Doubt it. Didn't come to my dad's funeral. I hold grudges. So, which is like, why didn't he want to marry me?
Why?
Like,
no, I mean like did he also love you and you loved him, but you just like,
yeah.
Why does that happen?
I don't know. We were so awful to each other.
Up. Right.
And it's like the worst, and love is not a construction paper heart, but it's also, so beautiful and so damaging. And I tried a lot of things to get over, this person, you know, like the standard things, like getting drunk.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, getting drunk, being like, I could date anyone. I could have, in the words of Beyonce, I could have another you in a minute. Like, so, yeah. And then I would, like, just text that boy 1,000 times, and I'd be like, why doesn't anyone love me?
Right.
What did you try? Before you turn to science.
Yeah, before science. Yeah. Okay, so I tried whiskey, and then I was like, maybe it's just, like, insufficiently sophisticated. So I was like, wine, you know? And then I figured it was just, like, the time distance thing. I think, until you cross a certain threshold, you're just like, oh, this is how this goes, you know? But then it was just like, well, how much of my life should I sort of just wait to be over?
Ooh, that's a bad one,
you know? So I tried, I moved. I've been to India crying about him. I've cried about him in Morocco, South Africa. I've been to some beautiful places.
I've cried all over the globe.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You're like, been around the world and I've cried.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, during that time, and it was a long enough expanse, that like there was one dude who I met. I was like, whoa, a different dude. I was like, we have really got a shot. And we did. And we had a pretty healthy, rad relationship. It ended for other reasons. But then as soon as it was over, it was like, I don't know. I'm not the gardener to know. What is it? Cicadas? That's a bug, not a rat. But like something that just comes right back up. Creeping Charlie.
Okay, my mom's in the audience, and she is a gardener, and I know she's told me this many times.
Wait, hold on. If we're quiet, can we yell and just say, like, what comes back if...
Buckthorn.
It was like buckthorn.
It was a buckthorn. It's a buckthorn. I'll tell you right now, it's expensive to remove. It is expensive, and it is prickly. It's painful. That was a great analogy. Maybe you should have a podcast. Okay, yeah, and so you were writing songs about this one dude for 10 or 12 years,
yeah.
But then in that interim, you also had other relationships, which I have such a, like, an issue with the idea of that love is, like, this finite resource, and that you start loving one person, and automatically that emotion shuts down for the other. And sometimes that does happen. Sometimes it is literally like a door slams and a window opens. I just coined that phrase. No one's ever heard it. Sometimes it's like that. And sometimes it's like you are in love with two people at the same time, not in the same way.
Yeah.
It's like polyamory in absentia.
Yeah.
Like, I'm in love with two people. One of them is not here. Like, I feel that way. Obviously, my situation is different. My first husband is dead. My current husband is in the second balcony because he didn't buy his tickets on time. So.
Sick burn.
Yeah.
It felt bad. I mean, but I think also part of it was like when you're 22, I think that you expect to have like a relationship with someone that is whole, like, I want all of you and you have all of me. And then by the time we're in our 30s, like, our lives are too complicated to do that. Like, here's the guy with whom I have my kids, or here's my ex-wife or my first husband. Like, so I think that probably we approach it with an expectation things are going to be, if not messier, they're at least going to be more complicated. So for me, the question was, can I, in a real way, give myself to this relationship that I was in and give it a shot? And the answer to that was yes. And to be honest, I was surprised when the old feelings came after we split. It was like, I didn't expect the train to come and run me down again. I thought I was done with that. It had been enough years that I thought I was safe from crazy train. And so I remember calling my best friend and being like, it's back. Yeah, I was surprised and bummed.
This is reminding me of a phrase from one of my favorite periodicals, In Touch. Weekly.
Right.
They have this thing where it's like, stars, they're just like us. God. And that's how I feel right now. They cry over crappy boyfriends.
I remember like the moment, or one of the moments when I decide, because I realize that that's nuts. I mean, I do realize, like, it's made a little more palatable maybe by the fact that I'm in the arts, so I can do an arts talk about it and take some of the edge off. But I just remember sitting in my car in the rain, in the parking lot of an all-you-can-eat sushi joint in the Second Ring suburb. And he had just called, like, to say something minor, you know, like, I don't know, something small. And as soon as the name, though, flashed, you know that feeling? I was like, he's gonna propose. And then when he obviously did not propose and I hung up, I just remember, like, my hands on the steering wheel and my forehead on the steering wheel, yelling in my own car alone in an all-you-can-eat spot, like, why can't you stop hoping? Like, where, you know what I mean? Like, where is the fuse box? How do I turn it off? And that's when I was like, science.
Yeah. Yeah. When all else fails.
Yeah. Part of the way that I perceive and understand, like, toughness is, I mean, it's very much the show. It's like, you can be tough pretending you're never scared. Or you can say, I'm scared and I'm going to stand here and tell you that I'm scared and take my punches in public and I'm not going to apologize for it. What's up? So, yeah, okay, but on the other hand, you know, it's like phrases like, you don't need a man. I mean, those sound true, but then, like, well, shit, certainly I'm acting like I need a man. Like, to try to reconcile what it means to be independent and self-reliant, which is just a synonym for independent, but also really, really want to pair and partner with someone, trying to figure out what's okay to give up to do that. There's little things like, oh, I don't like this house, and he does. Okay, well, that's fine. We know that. But as you escalate into some real shit, like, well, this isn't the city I want to live in. I don't want kids. I want monogamy. I mean, geez, like at what point are you just like not allowed to make another concession before you're jumped by a feminist street gang? Who's like, no. So, I don't know how, and sometimes I feel like, I don't know, like it's, I'm either the least woke or the most woke and I can't figure out which. Yeah.
It's really challenging.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is. I mean, I remember thinking that like wanting love made me somehow like love repellent. And so I would tell everybody that I was dating that I wasn't interested
in
like a boyfriend, even though I was like desperately hungry for a boyfriend. Like all my actions were like, love me. But then my words were like, I know I like literally don't care. Like you don't have to like call me back. But then I would be like, he has not.
Was it because of test? Cause then it wouldn't, cause it was like, if they could jump that hurdle where when you seem completely disinterested,
yeah.
Then they would have proved themselves to love you enough that it would be safe to reciprocate.
I think maybe, are you my therapist?
Maybe.
One question. And two, I have felt that there is this pressure to be cool. Yeah. And part of being cool as a woman is like making sure that your expectations for a partner are really low, like low enough that he could just trip over it. You know, and then I would be horrified when these man children who weren't even made of like anything resembling boyfriend material but didn't like form into viable life partners.
Right.
Even though, I mean, it was pretty clear when he stole toilet paper from a bar. Like that was what I now see as a red flag. A pretty clear one. At the time I was like, he's thrifty. That's great. That's a great quality. Like he's like,
yes,
I think like he's Amish. He's not. Like he's just.
What's the name for that year where they get to do anything?
Rumspringa.
Oh my God.
Knew it very quickly. Yes.
I was ready to go with Buckthorn again. But yeah, I mean, sometimes I find myself in romantic situations still being like, I'm cool with that. Where, yeah. What I'm really saying is, I'm a person who wishes that she was a person who was cool with that. You know? Yeah. But yeah, I think for me, like the phrase that I'm landing on now, and maybe I'll have a better one next year, is like, I do want to be partnered. And if I don't get the opportunity to find someone who I can do that well with and who I make better and makes me better, then I want to build a rad life that I can live well and fully on my own. So to acknowledge both, like I don't want a partner for fear. I want a partner for love.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Here's the thing. Not everybody has backstage passes to trade for access to an fMRI machine and a bunch of scientists at the University of Minnesota. So what about the normals? What do we do with those ram's horns, and maybe not even with like, you know, those ram's horns, but the thing that we can't let go of that happened 10 years ago or the, you know, what, help us.
I mean, I feel like this is like asking a rescue dog about Zen. Like if I knew how to do it without scientists, I would have done it. So the closest I can help you with is to teach you how to rap so that someday you do have backstage passes to trade.
And this is where Dessa announces her rap academy. For heartbroken girls. It's a boarding school. Dessa, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. This has been terrible. Thanks for asking. Our senior producer, also our only producer, but titles are important, is Hans Buto. Hannah Meacock Ross is our wonderful project manager. Jeff Kamen is our senior event producer, Corey Schreppel. He's our broadcast engineer, Erica DeSanto, still the lights. Our intern is Jacob Maldonado Medina. Huge thank you to Dan Zimmerman, Mike McQuiston, Alan Frechtman, Tom Campbell, Jeff and Ellie, Gregory Smith, and everybody here at the Fitzgerald Theater. This has been awesome. I don't think it's a secret that November is just the worst month. Like, for me personally, it's the worst. Like, just terrible month. Boo to November. I'd love to wipe it off the calendar, but I just don't have the power yet. This time of year is hard for a lot of people, and I mean, sometimes regardless of the time of year, it's just hard for people, okay? Things are just hard sometimes, and I was reminded of the fact that I'm not special, of the fact that grief is lonely, that loss is lonely, that life often, in general, can be very lonely, and I hope that you are not terrible tonight. But if you are, and if you are in the future, which you will be, I just want you to know that you don't have to be good. You don't have to be good at this, and that you never, ever, ever have to be fine. I said that I hate November, but I don't truly hate November. November took a lot from me, but November also brought me so many people in this room. It brought me 50% of my children who are here. We had some organic growth, some acquisitions. It brought me my current husband. It brought me his wonderful parents who are here tonight. And it brought me closer to my own family. It brought me closer to Aaron's family, who's also here tonight. And it brought me closer to Aaron, who I also know is here tonight and who I also know is always with me. In kind of the weird way Alyssa was talking about with her dad. But all of this, everything that I have is because of that man and because of his love. And it is also for him, for the love he gave me and the love that he gave me the ability to give to all of the new people that I love too. So thank you.